We're going to be just discussing, dedicating our learning this evening to the memory of the Kedoshim who were murdered this week in Har Nof in Yerushalayim, as well as in the merit of Rufuah Shleima, the number of people who are still in critical condition and in need of a speedy recovery. So we certainly have them in mind as well. Okay, so this evening we're going to continue our discussion of slavery. So just to make sure we're on the same page, we drew a basic distinction between two categories of a servitude. Really, there's one category called the Eved Ivri. And the Eved Ivri, or the Amah Ivriya, male and female counterparts, really we determined are not slaves at all. They're indentured servants. You have a scenario of someone who's in debt or someone who engages in theft is unable to repay that responsibility. So under certain circumstances, Beis Din will ensure that that individual becomes an indentured servant. We saw there are all sorts of halachot that are already embedded in the language of the Torah. Very careful how you treat them. After all, God enslaved us in Egypt. No one else can become a master. After all, you yourselves experience what it meant to be a slave. You cannot treat your fellow Jew in that sort of way. And Chazal pick up on this, and they elaborate many of these halachot, and they say that there have to be parting gifts for the indentured servant when that person lives, based on the language of the psukim. They describe the severe limitations in terms of how you're able to treat them. You're not allowed, for example, to insist that they do what we call busy work, right? And there's something that don't really need to be done, simply on the argument that that's going to ensure greater discipline on the part of the servant, which kind of makes sense. There's an argument to that. So someone's going to be idle all day long and give them something to do just to keep them kind of working. None of that is permissible. All sorts of different laws that drastically limit this. It goes free after 6 years if they do want to stay, so then you have to puncture the ear famously. All sorts of different halachot that we find in that context. And so we determined that essentially the notion of an indentured servant is not really slavery at all. That's not really what we're talking about. If we're going to ask basic questions about this institution from a Torah perspective, the real question that needs to be asked is not about the indentured servant, but really about the other category, not the Eved Ivri, but rather the Eved Kanani. Right? And talk about the Canaanite slave. There we're already talking about some sort of real slavery. Right? So someone who can be sold as goods, as property. Someone who can be worked very hard. There might be limits, but still, someone who can be worked extremely hard. Now, it may not be quite as extreme as what we recognize perhaps in the African-American slavery show. When we think about slavery in an American context, it might not be quite that extreme, but it's real slavery. And so really the question begs itself, sort of, how do we reconcile this? And certainly in the post-Civil War era, how do we understand post-civil rights era, what do we make of all this, and does it really work? Maybe we need to, you know, sometimes throw up our hands and say, you know, that's the Torah's philosophy, that's the Torah's philosophy. I think we'd probably be a little hesitant to swallow that pill. I don't think we're going to want to go in that direction. But this is where it becomes really a serious question.
So, I have a question. So this all takes place in Shemot. Mm-hmm. We're talking about slavery. Of course, during this time, the Israelites are leaving. Mm-hmm. Mitzrayim, and they're still in the Sinai at this point. So when does this take place? When do they have slavers? When do they have slavers? We're talking about when they reach Eretz Israel.
You're asking about the Canaanite slaves, or you're talking about?
Well, I mean, this is stated in Shemot. So is this come into play when they're in Israel, when they actually reach there?
Mm-hmm. We don't have any historical record. As a matter of principle, these laws seem to apply immediately.
Now,
the question is, did Jews have personal property in the sort of way that would allow for such a scenario? I mean, to some extent, the Jews did emerge from Egypt taking hordes of money. There was a notion of personal property. I'm not sure that it was evenly distributed, right? Like in any economic system, right? So I'm not sure that they necessarily took whatever they took from the Egyptians, and then we don't find that they then redistributed the wealth, right? We don't find the kibbutz model or anything like that. So it's plausible that even in the desert there was an exchange. Obviously, there wasn't the same need for clothing and for, and there wasn't money flowing presumably in the same way as would typically happen in a normal functioning economy, if only because there was no food, there were limited goods to purchase, right? There was no food to purchase, and you got what you got, and the mun was equally distributed, right? And in terms of clothing, right, you couldn't exactly go to your local mall and pick up, you know, your the most recent fashions. It wasn't going to happen. So, so we don't really have a sense fully as to what economic life looked like in the desert and how meaningful or active it really was. But in principle, halakhically speaking, it did apply in the desert. Was it acted upon? I'm not really sure. Unlikely. I suspect not. But I don't know if I can't say.
And what is where does an Evin Kadani come from?
So that comes from mostly from Parshat Behar. It doesn't, so it's in Sefer Vayikra. It's not described as extensively or clearly in Chumash. The Evin Ivri, Evin, and the Amah Ivri get the lion's share of the texts in Chumash. But in that section of Behar, which describes the Yovel and Canaanite slave going free in Yovel, that really becomes the anchor for this halacha. Mishpatim seems to be really primarily focused on the Evin Ivri.
Where do they come from? How did they become slaves?
How did they become slaves? How did anyone become a slave in the ancient world? It was...
What halakhic acts would one perform to transact, to come to own them? Are these prisoners of war? Are these... given the context mm-hmm. that they may be property...
Right.
Mm-hmm. But is there the wherewithal to say, well, I'm going to go traveling and I'm going to go pick up some people mm-hmm. and I'm going to sell them into slavery
right.
because I captured them
That's
the right. right of might.
Uh-huh.
Is that...
So it's interesting.
I'm talking about Canaan.
Yeah.
In we've already... Yeah. That's after we've already crossed Sinai, we've already been...
So in whatever it is, it's the concept of the Evin Kadani.
Right.
So in the desert, they could have been war captives. So they would be the people who were taken captive would
right.
be slaves.
Right,
and that would be a source for there. And any wars, and certainly in the Kibushar, it's that those were all, there were plenty of potential slaves to be had.
Right.
But beyond that, mm-hmm. Were there people going out and
right.
acquiring?
Right, 100%. So the historical evidence is scant. What I can tell you is that in Parshas Behar, we do not find it in the context of warfare. So in other words, the halachot are presented in sort of, in context of the way that a state would function or that an economy would function in the ancient Middle East, which included not only prisoners of war, but the free exchange of slaves as
so that they
as
were bought from somebody else.
Right. Now, presumably that's what would have happened. Now, that being said, I think that you're right that in the context of conquering the land and context of war, it's likely the first place that the Jews would have encountered this. That's a natural assumption. There were cases of individuals who were captured as slaves in Yoshua and so on and so forth. So it seems likely that those were the more common immediate implementations of this law. But to where you have it, right.
It's also...
Right.
How would we mm-hmm. then deal with it? Would it be halachic? Is it halachically dealt with in terms of... Fine, so you can... It's in fact of world commerce. People
right.
are selling people.
The assumption is that that was a legitimate...
But can you go acquire them?
The assumption
from
is that that's...
not being slaves. Make them slaves.
Well, how would that happen in any context?
The way the slavers worked here.
Mm-hmm.
What would be the halachic perspective of somebody going...
We just go to someone else and just say, you're my slave?
Going to Africa and acquiring people right. that would then be sold into slavery.
So
that's distasteful conceptually, but from a halachic perspective, would there be halachic issues with...
I mean, like, there's always going to be a question of how someone originally became a property to begin with. Like, what was that aboriginal moment when a person was... But however you deal with that, there is a notion of slavery as a halachically legitimate... When I say legitimate, I don't necessarily mean ethical, but it's a halachic category. And yes, if the slave trade is internationally recognized as such, then under similar circumstances, I could theoretically acquire such an individual. Now, how exactly I acquire them halachically? There's discussion in the Gemara about that. You have shtar, and you have different mechanisms that you use in order to acquire the Evin Kadani. But yes, in principle, that would work. And such a person would become my slave.
Or for themselves to be slaves because they knew they had nothing else to do, and then that life wouldn't be so bad being a slave. But it's really
right. That might be right. I'm not sure. For example, in African American slavery, though, that's necessarily how it always went.
No, that
Surely not. So it's interesting, right? So, but that raises an interesting question, which is sort of, could there be a slave that is generally internationally recognized as a slave from different societies, but halakhically maybe would not be recognized as a slave because it wasn't under quote-unquote legitimate circumstances? It's an interesting question that kind of emerges when Kenny's raising it. I don't know the answer. I haven't seen discussion of it, but it's something to think about. It's a fair point. So last time we just saw one more source, which I'm not going to review in depth now, but two important sources that begin to address this. The Rambam on page 5 of your source sheets that I'm not going to reread, but just quickly mention that the Rambam essentially concludes his treatment of the laws of slavery, which are just that, they're real laws of slavery, with sort of an ethical plea. And it's a very moving one at that, where the Rambam basically says, yes, it's true that technically and legally speaking, halakha recognizes the existence of this institution, but that doesn't make it ethical. That doesn't mean that a person should... Now, the Rambam goes stop short of saying a person should not own such a slave, but the Rambam does say that when someone has a slave, they should treat them with tremendous kindness and with rachman. And it's a very moving passage about how you shouldn't use your voice and you should treat them with dignity and you shouldn't overwork them, and that this is a characteristic that is intrinsic to what it means to be a Jew, that is a zaro shel Avraham Avinu, that the Kadosh Baruch Hu gave us the mitzvos to sort of craft their ethical personalities in this way, in the Tatzio Day. You should God is kind to all of his beings, including servants, so we should do the same. It's a very moving passage. On the one hand, it's beautiful. On the other hand, in a sense, it begs the question, because if slavery is so unethical, so then, again, so why is it even accepted as an institution to begin with? But that being said, the Rambam is certainly a very moving plea in that context. We then saw Professor Rubinstein, who about 90 years ago essentially made the point that many of the halakhic dimensions or events that permit a slave to go free, for example, like gouging out their eyes or maiming one of their limbs and these sorts of behaviors, and also the symbolism of the ears. So Professor Rubinstein points out, essentially, in the ancient Near East at that time, contemporaneously with the Torah, these were all, in fact, signs of enslavement. And you take a look at Tanakh, you see this all the time. So that Tzidkiyahu HaMelech, the last king of Malchut Yehudah, is captured at the time of the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash. And what did the Babylonians do to him? They gouge out his eyes. They blind him. Right? Same story with a famous character in Shoftim. Which personality is blinded when when the enemies of the Jews finally capture that individual? Who's blinded? And then he performs his last heroic act. Shimshon is blinded by the Plishtim, right? And then, right, he knocks down the pillars and he takes them all out. But again, he's blinded as a sign of slavery, that they have finally captured him. They have enslaved a great warrior, Shimshon, so they gouge out his eyes.
Okay, that's not servitude.
A little bit different, imperfect example, but he brings this as part of a larger... Tzidkiyahu is literally, and he points out that it's sort of a larger arc, even if it's not technically slavery, there's a sense that I've conquered you. It goes to the slavery in war, especially. But it's essentially a similar kind of motif. We find other examples in which limbs, specific limbs, are maimed in Tanakh. We have the example of Adoni Bezek, a case where his thumb was cut off, very gory stuff. He brings examples from Roman jurists who described the way that slaves were treated. Cicero is a famous Roman jurist who lived, I think, in the 2nd century BCE, who describes some of these actions, obviously much later than the Torah, but it's sort of the larger thrust is that many of the actions that we recognize in the Torah as being causes in halacha, as being the causes for the slaves to go free, were ironically signs of servitude at the time of the Torah. And so the point that the Torah is trying to really communicate is it's essentially taking the symbols of slavery in the ancient world and it inverts them. Essentially what it does is says these actions, which are symbolic of slavery, you do that to your slave, you go so far, it's over. It goes free. And so what the Torah is really trying to do is it accepts this institution, and yet in a sense, at least certain aspects, it inverts at the same time. Which leads us really to a larger thesis, which is not the only explanation that we're going to look at, but I'm going to jump to Rabbi Sachs and then circle back to Rivko. So if you join me on the bottom of page 8. So I gave you an excerpt from an article by Rabbi Sachs. He develops this in a number of places. I gave you just one example. And let's take a look at how he explains. And I think it works well, though it could be independent of Professor Rubenstein, but this is really representative of one entire camp. But Rabbi Sacks is really by way of example. He's, as usual, quite eloquent in his expression of this approach. But there are many others that I'll mention. I'll mention at least one or two others who develop this approach. And this I call a sort of a historical approach. And this is the approach that says that essentially the Torah accepted begrudgingly the institution of slavery, maybe not only the institution of slavery, but also the institution of slavery. And its goal was, while accepting it, to yet move us away from it, slowly but surely. And so the Torah works within a certain context or a certain moment in time, but its goal is ultimately to move us toward a higher good. It's sort of like an educator might, or a parent might, instead of everything all at once, instead moving us over the course of our experience in history. And so he writes, this is from his Covenants and Conversation. Anyone get his weekly emails? Anyone on that list?
You getting lists?
Anyone on his list?
Parents are.
So you can get on his, I'm not sure, I don't know if somehow I got on the list, but you can probably go on, he has his new, he no longer has the Chief Rabbi website. When he was no longer Chief Rabbi, he had to open everything up on his own. So he has now his own website, and he has his own new office, and he took all the secretaries with him, apparently, and they all moved over. So that's not uncommon. So he, so this is, so through that new site or whatever, they send out these weekly pieces. Last year was on leadership. The whole series every week was on leadership, and we started again this year. So he writes, I want in this study, just a few years ago, to look at one of Judaism's most distinctive and least understood characteristics, the chronological imagination. The modern world was shaped by four revolutions: the English, the American, the French, and the Russian. Okay, so just to get the years, right? So the English is talking about, right, the Reformation, basically. So 1648, the American, right? That's 1776, French, and the Russian. Okay. Two, the English. Oh, no. What did they cut off? Oh, no. Here. Is it not there?
Page 9.
I'm reading for you. I'm sorry about that. All right, you'll have to listen with me. So the English and so the first two, the English and the American, were inspired by the Hebrew Bible, which in the 16th and 17th centuries, because of the Reformation, the invention of printing, became widely available for the first time. The French and Russian revolutions, by contrast, were inspired not by religion but by philosophy. The French by the work of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, the Russian by the writings of Karl Marx. Their histories are markedly different. In England and America, revolution brought war. It led to a gradual growth of civil liberties, human rights, representative government, and eventually democracy. The French and Russian revolutions began with dreams of utopia and ended in a nightmare of hell. Both gave rise to terror and bloodshed and to the repression of human rights. What is the difference, asked Rabbi Sacks, between philosophy and the political vision at the heart of Tanakh? So as he's asking, essentially these seem to be fundamentally similar kinds of movements that attempted to bring greater freedoms, liberties to the world. Right? What was right? However, right, they went very differently. Right? The Reformation, the English and the American revolutions, right, they worked essentially over the course of the long term. Right? The latter two, the French and the Russian revolutions, right? The French was essentially, was roughly analogous in many ways to the American Revolution, although certainly differences in terms of nationalism, etc. And the Russian Revolution, very different, but still, those both failed. So what's the difference? He says one was built on religious principles, the other on philosophy. So what does Rabbi Sacks, who's a PhD in philosophy and loves quoting philosophers all day long, why is he blaming philosophy on all the ills of these two revolutions? And so he says as follows. The Sedra of Bahar sets out a revolutionary template for a society of justice, freedom, and human dignity. At its core is the idea of the Jubilee, right? Or what we all often call the Yovel, whose words proclaim liberty throughout all the lands until the inhabitants, and to all the inhabitants thereof, are engraved on one of the great symbols of freedom, the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia. All right. One of its provisions is the release of slaves. And he goes on and he quotes. And he says, the terms of the passage are clear. Slavery is wrong. It's an assault on the human condition. To be in the image of God is to be summoned to a life of freedom. Right? It says that the sovereignty of God means that we cannot own slaves. So ask Rabbi Sacks, right? Wait a second. If the Jewish position is that our historical experience teaches us that slavery is abhorrent, that it's against the will of God, and that the entire basis for the Jewish forming of a nation was the notion of liberty, then how can it be that that very same Torah allows for the institution of slavery? And so he says, yet the Torah does not abolish slavery. That is the paradox at the heart of Behar. To be sure, it was limited and humanized. Every 7 day, slaves were granted rest and taste of freedom. Another halach we didn't mention about giving a Shabbat off. In the 7th year, Israelite slaves were set free. If they chose otherwise to be, they were released in the Jubilee year. You could not hold a Jewish slave, even if they bore their ear. Once the Yovel comes, there's no permissibility to continue to own that slave. Right? So he says, everything dehumanizing about slavery was forbidden, yet slavery itself was not banned. Why not? If it was wrong, it should have been annulled. Why did the Torah allow a fundamentally flawed institution to continue? So what he does is he quotes the Rambam. He goes to the Rambam in his classic Moreh Nevuchim. The Rambam has a well-known theory with regard to korbanot. Right? Well-known and yet pretty controversial as well. What does the Rambam claim is Moreh Nevuchim? Right? So the Rambam, right? So the Rambam claims that what?
As a concession to the atonement.
Right, and then exactly eventually right. We won't have.
Right. Well, see, that's what's tricky.
But as you said before, it took korbanot and transformed them in a more directed and controlled way.
Right, 100%.
And did away with the, child sacrifice.
Right, 100%. Right? And according to many, the Rambam does not say this in the Moreh explicitly, in the Guide to the Perplexed, but according to many, that's the story of the Akedah. The story of the Akedah, what's fascinating about the story of the Akedah, about how we read the Akedah, I'd like to point this out, is that we always focus, and I think rightfully so, on the commands, sort of the beginning of the story, which is a really jarring story, and the fact that Avram is told this and goes through is truly remarkable, inspiring, perplexing. There's a lot, it's obviously a lot to say. But what sometimes gets lost in all that, because there's so much there to begin with, is the end of the story, which is not just that God had originally told him to offer his son as a sacrifice, but God also told him, stop, don't go ahead with it. And to us, that's sort of the obvious part. But to people living at that time, that was far from obvious at all. Right? That was a bent, right? That was a hallmark of paganism. Right? It was something that's really something that we found all the time. And that was really, the Chiddush of the Torah was not that a God could come to someone and command that they sacrifice their child. Right? That's already, right? That's passé, right? That's nothing new that Judaism has to contribute there. Right? Our contribution is that God says to stop. And so the Ram, although he doesn't quote the Akedah per se, I think it fits in nicely, and so the thrust of the Rambam's position is exactly that. It takes, it accepts the institution of sacrifice, but it molds it. It outlaws human sacrifice, and it limits it just to animal sacrifice, and it sort of contains it in just one location. It limits it, right? Once the Beit HaMikdash is built, that's really the only legitimate place for any meaningful sacrifice. Now, what's difficult is that the Rambam doesn't take it all the way. We would expect him, together with Rav Kook, who does go to this conclusion, to actually claim that, in fact, therefore, during the Messianic era, right, no dice, right? There would be no sacrifices permitted at all, right? And that's exactly what Rav Kook claims, at least with regard to animal sacrifices. Rav Kook says that it's going to be just korbanot mincha, flower offerings only. Right? He quotes the pasuk that we recite from Sefer Malachi at the end of Shon Esrei, Ve'arva LaHashem, it will be sweet to God, Minchat Yehuda, Yerushalayim, right? Which literally is generally understood as the gift of Judah and Jerusalem to God. But Rav Kook says, no, what does it say? What will be sweet in the Messianic era, right? The Karban Mincha, right? What about everything else? What, the animals, the rest of the Karbanos, they're not going to be sweet anymore? We got the sin offering, got this one, that one, right? Those aren't going to be. What happened to those? Rav Kook says, I'll tell you what happened to those. They went with the way of history. They're in that dustbin. Right? They're done. So that's what Rav Kook says. Problem is that the Rambam specifically does not. And this becomes a complexity for the thought of the Rambam. The Rambam kind of takes it only so far and somehow doesn't complete his line of thought. So the Rambam is a little bit problematic, but the core thesis that's enunciated, at least in that passage in the Moreh Nevuchim, is that the Torah will take problematic institutions, turn them into mitzvot sometimes, which is a dramatic statement, and yet seek to mold them and ultimately to limit or even eliminate them over the course of time. So Now, the Rambam is highly controversial, because once you say that about Korban, you can say that about lots of things. And what does that say about the intrinsic meaning of mitzvot? Well, not necessarily very much, in the sense of their underlying or omni-significance. And the Ramban, Nachmanides, is very upset at the Rambam, and he says, no. He says, what does it say about Korbanot? Yishei Reach Nichoach LaHashem. Says whatever this means. After Ramban, maybe understood this better than I did. But right, it's right, a sweet odor to God. Whatever that means, doesn't sound like this is God is like kind of like holding his nose, kiyacho, right, as it were, and saying right, fooey. It's a shame that we have to go through with this pagan barbaric practice. But what can I do? My children are not quite yet ready. Right, not exactly the impression that you get if it's this beautiful odor, right? It's attractive to God somehow. Again, whatever that means. So Ramban is very upset, but that's the Rambam's core principle. So says Rabbi Sachs, and this Rambam becomes a model for how to approach certain categories that seem difficult, right, ethically challenging in the Torah, and so he applies it in our context to slavery in particular. And this you do have looking on the back side on page 10, where he writes about seven lines down, God wanted mankind to abolish slavery, but by their own choice. The point is that if the Torah went too far too fast, what would happen? Right, it would backfire, and everything would fall apart, and you'd end up in a much worse place than you had begun. Right, God wanted mankind to abolish slavery, but by their own choice, and that takes time. Ancient economies were dependent upon slavery. The particular form dealt with in Bahar, slavery through poverty, was the functional equivalent of what is today called workfare, i.e. welfare benefit in return for work. Slavery as such was not abolished in Britain and America until the 19th century, in America not without a civil war. The challenge to which Torah legislation was an answer is, how can one create a social structure in which, of their own accord, people will eventually come to see slavery as wrong and freely choose to abandon it? The answer lay in a single death stroke: to change slavery from an ontological condition, what am I, to a temporary circumstance. No Israelite was allowed to be or see himself as a slave. He or she might be reduced to slavery for a period of time, but this was a passing plight, not an identity. And then he contrasts it to Aristotle. I'm going to hold off on that. And we'll see that inside in just a few moments, or a few minutes. He writes, for Aristotle, slavery is an ontological condition, a fact of birth. Okay? And then he comes to the final paragraph. There are profound differences between philosophy and Judaism, and one lies in their respective understandings of time. And again, to me, this is humorous. This is someone with a PhD in philosophy. This is someone who taught philosophy. This is someone his Rabbi Sachs is really his greatest. If you read, and he's extremely well read, and he's read everything, but his greatest concentration is in philosophy. And yet the thrust of this passage is to say that philosophy as applied to real world hasn't really worked, or at least, right, I mean, it's obviously overly simplistic, but the point is there's something about the purism of philosophy and its unwillingness to grapple with the realities and limitations of what it means for ethics to play out in entrenched societies, with deeply entrenched institutions upon which the very fabric and structure of those societies is built, right? And when you seek to impose those philosophical principles from the outside, sometimes that doesn't really work. Yeah. You agree. I thought you were gonna. What? You're what? In light. You're just what? You're hurrah. Hurrah. All right. Hooray, hooray. There are profound differences in philosophy and Judaism. One lies in the respective understanding of time. For Plato and his heirs, philosophy is about the truth that is timeless, or for Hegel or in Marx, about historical inevitability. Right? Note the. Right, the Hegel is not directly involved with communism, but is relevant in terms of a focus on the centrality of the state. And Marx, of course, the author of Communist Manifesto, and of course, obviously, a Jew. Judaism is about truths like human freedom that are realized in and through time. That is the difference in what I call the logical and chronological imaginations. The logical imagination yields truth as system. The chronological imagination yields truth as story. A story is a sequence of events extended through time. Revolutions based on philosophical system fail because change in human affairs takes time, and philosophy is incapable of understanding the human dimension of time. The inevitable result is that in Rousseau's famous line, they force men to be free, a contradiction in terms, and the reality of life under Soviet communism. Revolutions based on Tanakh succeed because they go with the grain of human nature, recognizing it takes time for people to change. The Torah did not abolish slavery, but set in motion a process that would lead people to come of their own accord to the conclusion that it was wrong. How it did so is one of the wonders of history. So essentially, if we focus just on the slavery part, I think there's a lot here, and I think it's very interesting in terms of thinking of these four revolutions as sort of the four great revolutions of modern time. I think this is a really fascinating kind of insight, to look at those four together, to draw a sharp distinction, to say, not just that it's difference between philosophy or sort of something imposed on the outside and a more organic or chronological approach to human development, but also the biblical piece. And I think that that's, to me, the really interesting part. The Reformation is the return to the text, the saying that we don't have to have the understanding of the Bible as mediated through the Pope or through the priest or through someone else, but every individual, especially in the wake of printing press, right, has unmediated access and therefore can be inspired by the traditions of the Bible in an immediate way. Certainly the American Revolution is deeply rooted in, this is a great class on its own right, in certainly in a sense of biblicism, a sense of return to the text, a sense that that the revolutionaries were themselves the new Israelites who are right, who are, you guys know all this, some fascinating stuff. Just one example, and then we can elaborate another time. But they really saw themselves as the new Israel who were fighting, and the king they saw as the Pharaoh. Ben Franklin, speaking of Philadelphia, actually developed a proposed seal for the United States of America, which you can easily find online, and it was. Unfortunately not accepted, which makes me very sad. But he essentially, what the seal depicts is a picture of the Israelites led by Moses through the sea with the clouds on one side and the fire on the other, and they're passing through and essentially it's exactly this. It's that the revolutionaries are the Israelites and they're passing, and that the British king is Pharaoh and so on and so forth. It's that story. God is, of course. Who else's side would he be on?
What's interesting, I think it's very compelling, this opinion, but what's interesting is that there's an inherent trust that people will come to this sort of higher level and be able to see that that slavery is not a good thing. Whereas someone could have a very different feel about humankind or Jewish kind of
Hobbesian kind of people might really, so
it's just this inherent good trust in the good.
But also, that's right. That I think is actually interesting that you're bringing that up. It's like, I always see, there's a perception that we were at our highest point and now we're constantly losing.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. So
this is the opposite.
Yeah, so this is very interesting for the whole notion of Yerida Hadorot, the decline of the generations.
Right.
And this really pushes back, and this is really, and there are tensions with that idea, because yes, you have a whole tradition of that, but you have sort of a counter tradition that first develops in Kabbalah and Jewish mysticism, which believes that somehow over the course of history things are rising or somehow improving. That's one whole tradition. And then you have the notion of evolution, which on one level challenged Jewish thought in certain ways, as we've discussed, but was co-opted by thinkers like Rav Kook, who saw really evolution as sort of a model for some sort of positive, right, ultimately ascent of humanity. And so he sees that as representative of spiritual growth and evolution over the course of time. The Rambam also has a notion, for example, that Christianity and Islam were wrong and problematic, and yet were a stage in the purification of humanity as they transition from polytheism on the road toward monotheism. Now, the Christian approach is not a pure monotheism. The Islamic approach is a pure monotheism, but we have other objections to their philosophical and religious principles and points of disagreement. But they are meant to take humanity along that trip. So you have this idea, and maybe individuals decline, but somehow as a larger society we grow. Is that a possibility? Is that coherent? Does that make sense? These are interesting questions. But yes, this would invert the whole thing. Absolutely. Great point.
Why is, if we accept this notion that somehow we have to come to it,
mm-hmm.
right? So why we don't hold that with murder? Murder, we come out
mm-hmm.
strong
mm-hmm.
and say
mm-hmm.
this is forbidden, this is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So what's unique about so is the reason it's framed this way is because mm-hmm. slavery was part of, but I mean murder was part of culture too.
Right.
So we didn't concede to that.
It's true. Although it's interesting, why was Cain not put to death?
There was no.
He didn't know. Okay, maybe.
Yeah.
It's just, I don't know. I'm wondering. Right, right. I mean, it's, I don't know. Other societies were killed. The Dorimamu were killed at later points when the things had crumbled. I don't know. I'm just wondering about if that was also sort of...
This idea is very compelling.
Uh-huh. But,
yeah,
you have to ask.
You know, Yosef Fruit. And the... Did everybody wrote? The Rees of Ardara?
In a Kol Mishnah.
It's really excellent.
He's a teenager. He didn't tell his parents. Why would he tell parents that?
Did you read Yoni Yosef's piece?
I'll give you a copy afterwards.
You have to read it.
What?
Really good. Anyway, the piece.
Make sure to send. We shouldn't assume that our kids are actually sharing with their parents.
Doesn't go home.
What would I see? Where would I see it?
That's really good. There's probably a copy of it.
We left copies around.
What are you talking about?
Publication.
Oh, yeah,
it was in Shul. There were multiple copies in Shul.
Yeah, it was great.
He makes this really, I don't know if he wasted on somebody or this argument that why Abraham, we had Abraham come to recognize Hashem.
Yes.
And,
that's right.
It's not taught in the Torah.
You're trying to take credit for my son, did.
What?
I said, are you trying
to... No, I'm remembering it because I edited it.
And the idea was that it's good that it wasn't there because each of us have to come to it. Because if we were instructed, then we would just follow the instruction. Right? Yeah. So it's sort of like, it's just a parallel to this that, like, if we just understood slavery's wrong. You know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, we understand murder's wrong, but it still doesn't stop people either.
Right.
Right? So.
Interesting.
But I'm just saying, what's unique about slavery?
But slavery isn't discussed after we were slaves.
You said what?
Slavery isn't discussed.
Right.
Until after we were slaves. So, just in terms of its murder. It's a function of right. Wholesale murder is not accepted.
Right.
It's still punished.
Right.
But you know, this idea that nation building or nations will dominate, they're not going to build their own pyramids. You know, this kind of labor is going to be done by others. So this concept of institutional slavery is part of that society and the early societies and obviously everyone since then. And so as we were slaves and we experienced that, now we're all saying, okay, so this is part of our experience. So listen, it is part of the human condition, but we've got to provide some, you know, whatever. But it did come from the fact, distinct from maybe some of, we actually had that experience nationally.
Mm-hmm. Sort of had to be accepted in a way. Good news. Okay, so that's one, I think, attractive approach. If anyone's interested, the Rosh Yeshiva of Ma'aliyah Dumim, Rav Rabinovich, Rav Nachum Rabinovich, very interesting thinker, happens to be a Rebbe of Rabbi Sachs. Rabbi Sachs did not grow up with a traditional Jewish education, but then he came to it, and he spent many, many years learning with Rav Rabinovich. Happens to be, I think, surely no coincidence, he has a long article, originally written in Hebrew, elaborated to a book called Darkah Shel Torah. It's also translated to English. It's a long article, but he develops this idea much more extensively in context of slavery, but other context as well, and he essentially says this is sort of the larger way in which the Torah is meant to work. Don't understand it as sort of an ideal system that only stands above time. Certainly its fundamental principles stand above time or timeless, but it also is meant to work through history and meant to take us as individuals and as a society from one place to another, and that may take millennia. And we just have to have sort of the breadth of, it may take a lifetime for an individual, we have to sort of have the breadth of vision to be able to take that step back and understand that really the Torah has sort of these overarching historical aims that many of its commandments seek to connect. So if anyone's interested, I can give you it's available online. It's a really fascinating piece for that and lots of other reasons. Now I want to take a look at a different approach, which was a little bit surprising to me when I matched up the author with what he says. And this is Rav Kook. If you take a look on page 7, source 13. Rav Kook here is from his collection of letters, this passage. This is a letter that was written to him by a professor I believe the name of the professor is Professor Meisels. It's spelled M-E-I-S-E-L-S, who asked him all sorts of fascinating questions, ranging from how we grapple with heretics in the Jewish community, to matters of slavery, to the question of evolution, all sorts of interesting things. A very curious, broad person who happened to have a personal relationship with Rav Kook, and he asked him about all sorts of different things. I give this to you here. A little bit of a different approach. So Rav Kook says a number of things about slavery in this context. This is one. This is not, I don't want to misrepresent this as sort of the whole of Rav Kook's approach, even within the context of just this letter. But this argument, I think, is a very different kind of perspective, and I think provides a counterpoint to the approach taken by Rabbi Sachs and Rabbi Rabinovich. So he writes, "You should know that slavery is with all the moral upstanding ways of God, in which the righteous walk and the evil stumble, never in itself caused any fault or error. Slavery is a natural law amongst the human race. Indeed, there is no difference between legal slavery and natural slavery. In fact, legal slavery is within the jurisdiction of Torah and is legislated in order to control certain flaws in this, because God anticipated the reality of natural slavery. Let me explain. Reality places that there are rich and poor, weak and strong. A person who has great wealth hires poor people legally in order to do his work. These employees are, in fact, natural slaves due to their socioeconomic standing. For example, coal miners. These people go to work in the mines of their own free will, but they are, in effect, slaves to their employers. And maybe if they were actually owned by their employer, they would be better off. The rich with their stone hearts scoff at all morals and ethics. They don't care if the mines lack air and light, even if this shortens the life expectancy of their workers, whose numbers run into the tens of thousands, many of whom become critically ill." Right? See China, case in point. "They certainly won't engage in any extra expense to improve working conditions in the mines, and if a mine shaft collapses, burying workers alive, they don't care. Tomorrow they'll find new workers to employ. If these people were owned by the master by legal slavery, he would have a financial interest to look after the lives and well-being, because they're his own assets." So is Rav Kook saying that slavery is inherently problematic, objectionable, antithetical to all the values of the Torah? It's just that the Torah couldn't eliminate it in one fell swoop, because after all, society, the economy, was based on slavery. You couldn't separate them, and it took 2,000 years or 3,500 years, whatever, plus civil wars and who knows what else, in order to eliminate it. Is that Rav Kook's approach? Right? Okay. Anything but. Right? Rav Kook is, at least in this passage, seeking to somehow come to terms with slavery. Right?
Which also doesn't make sense for Rav Kook.
Yeah, it's very. That's why I said.
Like shrewd, and all sorts of things he says are not an ideal state.
It's very interesting.
But
Rav Kook was, in certain senses, a very consistent thinker in very deep ways. But he was constantly exploring new ideas, and they came bubbling to the surface at all sorts of different times in all sorts of different ways. And his poetry contradicts itself at times, and his ideas are just—he's just like this rising force of ideas. And sometimes you find things that give a very different impression that you find in other parts.
When was this written? What stage of his?
This is written. So this is Tafrei Samech Daled. So this is if we're in, it's basically 101 years ago. So it's 1913. He is what?
So it was earlier. It wasn't his.
This is in Chelek Aleph. The letters are organized chronologically. So Chelek Aleph is a little bit earlier than some of the other ones. So this is. No, it's not. It's not 19. It's 1904. Sorry, a little bit early. 1904 is right around the time Rav Kook moves to Israel. In 1904, he becomes the chief rabbi of Yafa. He was born in 1865. At age 39, 40, in 1904, he moves from Eastern Europe. He was rabbi in a number of communities, and he takes the position in Yafa. So it's just when he's. It's either. Just, I think it's just after. I'm not sure, but it's right around the time of that transition. So it's not young. But it is in the earlier stages of the more prominent positions of his career. That's possible. There's been a lot of historical work done. Professor Yehuda Mirsky if anyone knows the name, recently published a biography of Rav Kook. Highly recommend it. It's fantastic. It's really, really a rich biography. Joel knows him well. Anyhow, so his dissertation, not that book, his dissertation is on the development of Rav Kook's thought in the first 40 years of his life, which people don't really pay attention to, because that was when he was still in Eastern Europe, he was in Israel, and didn't have its published tshuvot that were relevant for the kibbutznikim and all these really fascinating things that everyone talks about in the later parts of his life. The first 40 years are relatively neglected, and he shows the transition, and he basically argues in his dissertation that Rav Kook, in his formative or earlier years, is thinking about things in a more individualist kind of way, which makes sense. He's not yet in Israel thinking about the notion of a larger Klal Yisrael and that has ramifications, but he's thinking about things differently. So the notion that he might evolve toward a greater embrace of evolutionary thinking is pretty reasonable, I think, in the term. What's his core argument, though? What is the argument? Right? He says slavery is...
natural.
Right? It's natural. It's natural law. It's inevitable. He doesn't mean Rav Kook is applauding it, but he's saying it's inevitable in 1904. That's really interesting. This is long after the Civil War.
It is to some degree a semantic issue.
Yes, that's correct. Go ahead.
He's calling it that.
That's correct. What is he describing here? Yeah.
Labor. This is the evolution of unions and things along those lines.
That's right. I think it's a really important point. When we think about slavery, and this is going to be relevant for Aristotle as well, what does that mean, that slavery? Does that mean that differentiation? Because the truth is that you could argue that there's sort of just a spectrum from any level of class distinction at all in society to extreme, horrific forms of slavery. Now, that doesn't mean they don't draw the line somewhere and say, okay, past this line, that's out of bounds, that's already, right, that's mistreated, that's abusive, and anything else is called how society functions, because otherwise you've got something like communism, we know how that turns out. So, you know, the notion that there can be classes, and that to some extent there's a word, you know, inevitable, and that people employ other people, it's complicated. I mean, we live with these things in our community.
We don't buy and sell people. That's the key distinction.
It's very subtle.
Treat you even worse than I would, like he points out.
That's
maybe
right.
It would be better for them if they owned them.
That's right.
Because as their own property.
But hold on.
Doesn't bear that out necessarily. History doesn't necessarily bear that out.
No.
Slave owners were mostly cheating.
That's a key distinction in the semantic issue.
You're making a separate point. You're going through Rav Kook's core point, which is that it's not 100% clear. That it always worked that way.
People are bad. At the end of the day, the human condition is not a... We have to really work at it to be good.
It's nothing.
The inertia is not a... It's not often positive.
No. 100%. Now, I just want to say, though, Kenny, to your point, it's true that he's talking here in this piece about mineshaft workers, and that's not the same thing necessarily as slavery. But remember that this letter was written to Rav Kook in an attempt to understand how the Torah can, right, endorse the institution of slavery. So it's true that your point, your distinction is well taken, but that's not what Rav Kook is doing here. So I think that needs to be said.
He says here, Tom, there's no difference between legal slavery and natural slavery.
Yeah.
And the whole paragraph is actually explains that...
That there is a difference. Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think what he means to say is that when legal slavery comes along, it doesn't mean to invent the category. What it means to say is that there is a given of natural slavery that exists, and legal slavery is just an attempt to massage that in a way that makes things a little bit more bearable, manageable for people who are inevitably going to be in dire conditions no matter what. So I think that's what he means. I think it's a little bit misleading. I think you're right. Yeah, 100%. So now, again, I don't mean to say this is the sum total of Rav Kook's philosophy on slavery, but it is representative of a very different kind of approach, and that's basically, instead of saying that this is something horrific that the Torah wants to get rid of, and you could use, by the way, the Rambam, right, that we saw at the end of the laws of slavery, the end of the Chara Vadim, I think could work nicely. It's not exactly the same, but it kind of fits with the application of his theory with regard to Carbonot, right? He says he doesn't quite go so far as to say it's unethical to have a slave, but he says basically the way that most people treat their slaves is barbaric and against the principles of the Torah. So I think it doesn't have to work, but I think it could work kind of nicely. Then alongside that, you have a very different approach, which says that no, slavery fundamentally is acceptable, and the Torah sort of is kind of timeless in that sense. Again, the irony of Rav Kook being the one who says this, but that's this perspective. And then, right, if it's inevitable, at least we're framing it, we're massaging it, we're making it a little bit more humane in the ugly world that really is the real world. Now, I think it's very clear, and we already saw this quickly, although I jumped over a little bit in Rabbi Sachs, it's pretty clear that this is coming from Aristotle. A little bit late, I'm not going to read the whole thing, you can take a look, but it's very clear in the Politics that basically Aristotle makes the case for slavery as a natural law. Now, what your natural law is and what you think is sort of an inevitability of the human condition is sometimes, perhaps, arguably, contingent on what you perceive of the human condition around you and the world that you live in, which, of course, itself is a little bit of an argument against natural law, because the whole idea of natural law is that there are certain things that are embedded in the human condition. But Aristotle basically asks the question, is all slavery a violation of nature? And his response is, the answer is no. Right? There's no difficulty, on top of page 8, there's no difficulty in answering this question on grounds both of reason and of fact. For that some should rule and others be ruled is a thing not only necessary, but expedient. From the hour of their birth, some are marked out for subjection, others for rule. And he goes on to argue that even within an individual person, we have both physical and spiritual aspects that vie for sort of control over our sense of self, that vie for mastery over us, and our goal is to engage in self-mastery. And basically, the better people are the people who are able to use mind over matter and to overcome their bestial physical instincts and to discipline themselves, right? This is kind of the dinner test. Who would you rather go out to dinner with? The person whose material bestial side rules over their intellect, or vice versa, okay? Right? All things being equal, right? You'd probably eat with your refined friend. And he says that what is true within a person is true between people as well, and that the notion that there's an inevitability that there's a natural law that saying that the natural law is that the intellect or sort of the mind over matter, so too with regard to people, there are some people who are inevitably going to be in different castes of society, and that, he claims, is a natural law. And that isn't what Rabbi Sachs called an ontological condition. It is an essential fabric of being as being part of a society. And that's basically the thrust of what Aristotle says here. So to me, when I read this passage of Rav Kook, where he says that slavery is a natural law amongst the human race, right? Or in the Hebrew, ki etzem chok ha'avdut hu chok tiv'i b'vnei Adam, and I ask myself, this is not Cookian thought at all, where is he coming from? I think it's very clear that the language is drawn really directly from Aristotle. Now, whether Rav Kook was reading Aristotle or he got it mediated through the Haskalah thinkers that he liked to read, anyone's guess, but
the key distinction on that is according to the Greeks, there, the caste society, if you were of a particular caste, you, your children, your grandchildren, and until the end of time will be slaves. Whereas, according to the Torah, never have that, because every yovel you're freed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that would mean everybody's free, which means you can't have castes.
I think that's a great point. Rabbi Sachs, I think you're right. It's a question, I don't know. I agree with you. Rabbi Sachs, in another piece related, makes this argument about Greek tragedy. That, right, Greek tragedy is always about fate, and it's about the inevitability of fate. And basically, Greek tragedies are about, right, essentially, Aristotle actually writes that this is what a Greek tragedy is in its sort of in its essence, quintessence is basically, right, that what happens from the beginning to the end of the tragedy is essentially nothing, in the sense that there's an oracle, we know exactly what's going to happen, human beings try to elude their fate, right, one way or another, and the end of the tragedy essentially is, right, right, is excessive. So Antigone and Oedipus, you know, all that, that's exactly what the story is. And so it's very much this. And I think you're right. It's not the general approach that we have, and it's in slavery, it doesn't seem to fit that detail as well. But I think it's very interesting to see Ruth Cook. So I think that you have here, some of us may be more inclined to Robert Sachs's perspective, but really different models of attempts to deal with this, whether it's to justify the institution inherently somehow, or whether it's to say that really it's something that we ultimately want to remove. It's a scourge, but it just takes a lot of time and effort and complexity to get there. God willing, next time we will look at some Civil War perspectives on this issue. Dueling sermons that were written immediately before the outbreak of the Civil War. One of the pictures of the rabbis, Rabbi Raphael, is actually from the collection of Shalom Yulam, my uncle, who's a Civil War historian. So I only noticed that when I printed it out. I was like so excited, not printed it out, but when I looked at it. Good, so that was the only question. We have to figure that out in 1 second, but I think everyone.